Are we finally getting our arms around how to prevent suicide?
The best medication for type 2 diabetes.
Should people who have blockages of their heart vessels have surgery to help?
And the risk of a stroke after having a TIA.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on April 22nd, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn right to The Lancet, a really large, comprehensive look at a multitude of strategies to help prevent suicide in those who are deemed at risk for that. Suicide, of course, I'll just frame it up, a huge public health issue here in the United States. Tens of thousands of people dying annually as a result. Looks like they could have a strategy that might help.
And you're right, Elizabeth. It was a large study. A large study looked at over 19,000 individuals who had committed suicide in the United Kingdom. But the principles there make this study that was done on the other side of the pond quite relevant to us. They looked at reducing suicide through improved quality of care, the services provided, and then the organizational structure. And that second part is what's unique about this particular study. They performed what's called an ecological study. You can't do a randomized controlled trial of suicide. Over the course of the 15 years that this study was done, there were 16 different services that were recommended to be implemented to improve care for people with mental health issues that might be prone to committing suicide. And these 16 policies related to safety in the hospital, availability of community services, staff training, adoption of specific policies. And what they determined was, as these rolled out, there was clear evidence that the increase in services reduced suicide by about 20 to 30%. Now, they couldn't decide which particular policy because these were ongoing, and some of the institutions across the UK had adopted some policies, some not others. But it was clear that these services did improve the rate of suicide, or did lower it. The second thing they looked at was the organizational structure. This was turnover of staff, for example, incident reporting. And the incident reporting implies that there's a culture of safety. And these things also affected the rate of suicide. This gives us insight into what system-wide changes we can implement along the patient care pathway that could be key strategies for improving safety and mental health care.
Was there any assessment in this study of how much it cost to implement these changes?
None at all. Again, this was done in the United Kingdom. Many of these were done under what are called the NICE guidelines, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. And as we know, in the United Kingdom, they're concerned not only with the quality of care, but the cost of it.
Is it your assessment then that these would be fairly easy strategies to implement in our healthcare system?
The service things they did are very easy to do, making the hospital safer, adopting specific policies and guidelines, making community services available. It also implies that the organization itself has to be functional. There can't be a high turnover. If we do, there's not the continuity of care. And there has to be a culture where we actually try to improve safety and we don't penalize people for doing it. So I think both the service and the organizational qualities can be adopted.
Well, these organizational strategies that you point out sound like they would have a huge benefit, not just in the suicidality issue, but also in safety in the hospital issue and a whole range of other things.
We've seen that with other issues. How is care provided in the emergency room, or how is care provided in the surgical suites, or even up on the floor? These safety issues clearly improve patient outcome.
Speaking of patient outcomes, something I thought was just really remarkable. In the New England Journal of Medicine, people who have CABG, coronary artery bypass grafting, gosh, we've gone back and forth. If you've got atherosclerosis, blockage in those arteries in your heart, does really good medical therapy achieve the same outcome without having to have surgery? And I was just pretty amazed by this study.
This study focused on a group that we've not had any data for in the last 30 or 40 years. People that not only have blockage in their arteries, but also have depressed heart function as well. We measure by what's called an ejection fraction. Most people, their heart doesn't eject all the blood with each beat. It ejects about 60 or 70% of the blood. In individuals that eject less than 35%, they have a condition called a cardiomyopathy. Their heart's not working well. The muscle's not working well. And if it's due to blockages, it's called an ischemic cardiomyopathy. Years ago, the surgical techniques were not very good. And when you operated on these individuals, their outcome wasn't very good. So we weren't really sure which patients might benefit from surgery and which might benefit from medical therapy. Fast forward to 2016, the surgery is better, the techniques we use for it are better, and the outcomes are better. So in this particular study, they looked at over 1,200 patients who had an ischemic cardiomyopathy and randomized them to the best medical therapy, which, by the way, has gotten better over the last 20 or 30 years, or best medical therapy plus surgery. And they followed them for the course of 10 years. And the primary outcome was death from any cause. Those that received surgery, 60% had died. And those that received medical therapy alone, 66% had died over a 10-year period. That highlights two things. One is this is a mortality of about 6% per year. So this is a very high-risk group. But there was a benefit, about a 16% reduction in mortality associated with bypass surgery. And the groups that seemed to benefit most were those that had the most extensive blockages and also in individuals under the age of 60. Now, what our listeners should realize is for the first 2 years, the surgical group did worse. But from years 2 to 10, the surgery group did better.
Couple questions about this. Wonder if these findings are going to apply to other folks who have atherosclerosis and blockages in their coronary arteries. That's one question. And the other question is, I wonder with earlier identification of people who may be headed into this direction, if the implementation of that comprehensive medical approach would ameliorate the need for surgery.
I recently participated in the guidelines that said who should get either the stent or who should receive bypass surgery in those with normal heart function. The guidelines suggest that the more extensive the disease, the more likely people are to benefit from surgery than with medicines alone. This extends that to those with depressed heart function. Obviously, the prevention, putting people on the right medications, the right preventive course is preferable.
Well, this is certainly a question that's been out there for a while, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Another question in the New England Journal of Medicine that's been out there for a while, the issue of, wow, if you've had a TIA, a transient ischemic attack, a little mini stroke, as it were, what is your risk of having a subsequent one?
So these are people that have transient neurologic symptoms that resolve over a fairly short period of time. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, it was estimated the risk of having a stroke or having a heart attack during the first 3 months after TIA was to be 12 to 20%. We now have stroke specialists. We're encouraging people to get in to see the physicians earlier when their symptoms begin. We have newer medical therapy. So what's that risk now? To address this, from 2009 through 2011, investigators enrolled almost 4,800 patients at 61 different sites in 21 different countries. They had a documented TIA or minor stroke, and they were followed for the subsequent year. The one-year event rate for having any cardiovascular outcome, a stroke, a heart attack, or death from cardiovascular disease, was 6.2%. And the risk of having a stroke was 5.1%, much lower than what we experienced 20 years ago. Now, can we predict who those individuals might be? People that had multiple strokes in the past, that was a risk factor. If they have a large artery involved with atherosclerosis, if they had advanced age, high blood pressure, longer duration of symptoms, or presence of diabetes, these also were risk factors.
I like this because I think it really, first of all, demonstrates that the risk is much lower than we thought. So I think that's good news. But I think the other part of it that's good news is honing in on exactly who is at risk and making sure that those folks have a lot more surveillance.
And I want to stress to our listeners the importance when symptoms begin of getting very early treatment. What this study shows is that for those that receive the best care and do so quickly, there's a 95% chance they won't have a recurrent stroke or recurrent TIA over the next year. That's pretty amazing.
We like it. Finally, then, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. I like this one, too. This was an affirmation that metformin, an oral agent for diabetes, should, could, would, shall be the first line therapy when starting someone on such a medicine.
Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, affects about 9% of the U.S. population. And currently, we have more than 7 different classes of diabetic medications. They differ in their effects on glucose lowering, on safety, and other important outcomes. So what these investigators did was they evaluated all English language studies through March of 2015 that compared different medications. They concluded that metformin as first-line therapy was best because it was safer. It had the same beneficial effects on hemoglobin A1C as the other agents. It was less likely to cause weight gain, and it also had benefit with regard to cardiovascular mortality.
Not to mention the fact that, of course, it's been around for a really long time, and it's probably the least expensive of all of these other agents. The other thing I would like to note is that I'm seeing abundant evidence from lots of different studies relating some of these other classes of medicines to things like bladder cancer or other kinds of side effects that don't emerge until the drug has been on the market for a while and we're able to see those things. And so that's something that can also be avoided with metformin.
Now, metformin does have some side effects, mostly gastrointestinal. Again, your point's well taken. An established medication, years of use and effective, especially with regard to reducing cardiovascular mortality.
And the last thing, of course, I would say about that is the public health message relative to the management of type 2 diabetes. And that is, hey, folks, those lifestyle changes, really changing your diet, getting out there and exercising, could well make it so that the only thing you need in your lifetime is metformin if you need an oral agent. You don't have to move on to any of the second agents or even to insulin.
Thanks for mentioning that. You're absolutely right.
That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.